Okay, just for the record, we are all now on the record. So feel free to carry on. I don't want to interrupt. I just didn't want anyone to say anything that they'd regret being out on the internet, which I may do at some point over the next few minutes. Good morning. How are we all doing? Cold?
Cold.
Cold? Alert? No. All right. Well, we'll see what we can do about that in the coming minutes. So good to see you all. Some of you may not have noticed I reverted back to the font of the previous instantiation. I preferred that on reflection, and that was the end of that. So Parashat Vayeshev is another chock-filled parasha. A lot of events unfold, a lot of episodes take place, and there is, as far as one central character is concerned, who's the central character of the narrative in this parasha? Yosef. This is Joseph, and if we were to call this parasha purely by his character's experience, this would be called the fall of Joseph. It begins with him as the favorite son, with his special coat, with his parents, his father's favoritism, I should say. And how does it end? What is the final scene in this parasha? I don't expect everyone to know this off the cuff. If you do, wonderful.
He's riding in jail.
He's in jail and has been forgotten. The butler's gone back up, and it says, and he forgot about Joseph. So we've got the favorite son of his father in the land of Israel at the beginning, at the end of the parasha. He's in the jail in Egypt, forgotten, neglected, unloved, and alone. This would be the fall of Joseph. Next week, we would call the rise of Joseph. He starts in that jail, and he ends up viceroy of Egypt. And there's an interesting inflection that there's almost a V-shape of these parashas. He begins on top at the beginning of Vayeshev and goes down in between. By the end of Miketz, he's back on top. And there's a question about what shifts at that moment, the nexus between the parashas that Rabbi Riskin has a fabulous reading of, which I guess I'll, now that I've drummed it up, leave you in suspense for a week so I can have something to say next week. So let's have a look at Parashat Vayeshev scene by scene. It begins, Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Megurei Aviv Eretz Canaan. Yaakov was dwelling in the land of his fathers, in the land of Canaan. That is the first pasuk we'll come back to on our sheet in a moment, which in itself ripples with mystery that we'll have to address. We then have the description of Joseph among his brothers, and I actually, if you have a chumash, wonderful. If not, I'll say it outside. I'd like to look at these couple of psukim, because the entire fallout with Joseph and his brothers, the jealousy, the envy, the violence, is astonishing. These are our tribal, noble ancestors. And even if we don't have the view that the patriarchs were perfect, immaculate, they were untouchable, we still presume they have to be noble in some sense, that we have to admire them. They have to be figures of weight and character. And here we have a scene of mob rule, where there are brothers who are vicious, who plot, who scheme, who seek to strip their brother of dignity, throw him in a pit, possibly murder him on the spot. Reuven intercedes to stop them doing it. This is a crazy scene, which haunts Jewish history in some sense. In fact, on Yom Kippur, when we read in Musaf the story of the 10 martyrs, the blame for that is put at the feet of the brothers for having sold Joseph. So it does haunt Jewish history. We say the same thing on Tisha B'Av, they sold their brother. This is a low moment in Jewish history. But for a number of the commentators, it can't be that simple. It can't just be that they were these base, urge-driven, impulsive figures who were jealous and cast their brother in a pit. There has to be more. And in fact, the Malbim suggests, the most important figure in Jewish history, the Malbim, suggests, they'll get old, you know, in a couple of years, maybe. The Malbim says that the brothers thought they were doing the right thing. And if you look back in the last few parashas of a Jewish history, there's always been, so to speak, the elected child and the rejected child. Avram has two children, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Who's chosen? Yitzchak. Yitzchak has two children, Yaakov and Esav. Who's chosen? Yaakov. There is an assumption genetically going back that there is a chosen line, and there is an intercessor. Rabbi Sachs, actually, in his book, Not in God's Name, has a whole thesis that not being chosen is not the same as being rejected, and he's got a long argument that this is not a history of rejection, just that everyone has their own task. In some sense, that's his thesis writ large, starting with Dignity of Difference, which he got in trouble for, and then had to republish with a slightly edited version. And not that he didn't stand by the first, but he wanted to at least concede to the critics. But let's just use that principle generally. There is a chosen line. So the brothers here, descendant of Jacob, think there's going to be an interloper. There's going to be a figure who will be rejected, who will be cast aside, who carries that Ishmaelite, Esau-like character that we need to dispose of. So there's inbuilt suspicion into the, you know, Thanksgiving tables have always been tense places. And this is, they're sitting there thinking, who's going to be rejected? Who's going to be cast out? And the brothers see Yosef as haughty, as arrogant, as naive, as conceited, self-content. And they think, this guy, this is bad news. We need to be rid of him. And they think they're doing a service for the Jewish people. This is the way the Malbim construes it. I see that some of you find this to be less than compelling. But this is the way he resolves that ethical issue, that we have these noble figures, which he says were wrong. They misjudged. They judged too quickly. But what is in their mind? What is their motive? Are they malicious? Are they impulsive? Are they driven by emotion and just angry? Or is there some high aspiration, even if they misjudged and made a catastrophic error? And he suggests that they made the error of judging too quickly, but at least in their mind, they had the right idea. Malbim does a similar thing with Cain and Hevel. We didn't talk about it in Bereishis, actually. But Cain seems to be the epitome of impulsive fraternal relation. He kills his brother. And on the face of it, it looks like it's out of impulse. The Malbim has a radical reading of the scene that suggests actually it was not cold-blooded impulsive murder, which may sound paradoxical, but actually it was well-intentioned. He thought he was doing what God told him to do, which we'll have to look back at that text to see that. That's Cain. So what did they see in Yosef that made them think he was bad? And how does it actually turn out that he was good? So in the Pesukim at the beginning of the parasha, I'll read. It's actually one Pasuk. Ela toldot Yaakov. These are the generations of Jacob. What usually follows when we say Ela toldot Yitzchak, Ela toldot Esav, Ela toldot Yishmael? List the names. Ela toldot Yaakov. Yosef ben Shavasre Shana Haya. Joseph was 17. Haya roe et achiv batzon. And he shepherded with his brothers with sheep. His generations were sheep. There seems to be a pretty strange interruption. We don't get the usual unfolding of the genealogy here. There is almost, it is a disruption, an interruption in the scene. It's almost like, oh, everything was well, and this is the genealogy of Jacob, whoa, whoa, whoa. Before we get to that, there's a massive story we need to tell. Joseph was 17. Roe et echav batzon, and he shepherded sheep with his brothers, v'hu na'ar, and he was a na'ar, which we translate as a lad. That is how they used to translate it. Thank you, King James. How would we translate na'ar in more contemporary terms?
Unmarried.
Unmarried. Kid. Simple. Immature. Teenager. Youth. I think youth is probably the most associated term that what lad would have meant. No one says lad. I mean, in England, people say nice lad, good chap, right? But nobody knows what that means. A youth is probably the least loaded term than we can come up with, because adolescent has its own connotations. Teenager, I'm sure for many of us, have its own connotations. Immature certainly does. Unmarried, it's interesting. Maybe that is the technical usage, although when Moses cries in the basket, it says, "V'hanar bocher." The youth was crying, and, you know, it's odd to have married babies. So it would be a strange remark to make. In those days, they had arranged marriages, maybe, but it's an interesting possibility. And actually, we'll talk about that then. But when it says, and she saw the baby in the basket, v'hanar bocher, and the youth was crying, everyone's puzzled why, number one, a baby is being called a na'ar. And number two, in the same pasuk, it calls him a baby and a na'ar. One resolution, actually, is that it wasn't Moses who was crying. That it was his brother Aaron at the side. V'hanar bocheh, and the brother was crying. And maybe he was unmarried, and maybe that was a little plug for him to, you know, find a shidduch. Who knows? But either way, this seems to be a... Let's try to keep it as neutral as possible. V'hanar, he was a youth. Why would that seem to be obvious to us that he's a youth? It says he's 17, so it seems redundant either way. We're going to have to figure out what's going on. Et b'nei Bilhav, et b'nei Zilpah, Nishay Aviv, the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, the wives of his father, v'yavo Yosef idibatam ra'al avihem, and Joseph brought the bad words of his brother to their father. So usually, why do the brothers dislike him, are we told?
He's a tattletale.
He's a tattletale, meaning he used to sit around listening, what are they going to do? Bad, oh, I saw what he did, and they go and tell their father. It's interesting. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who I've mentioned a couple times, I'm sure many of you are familiar with him. When I was in Gush back in the day, all those years ago, they did auctioning off before Shabbat Zachar. They would auction off mincha to the students, and the Brits would get together, and we'd pull our, 20 shekels, and we'd try and buy something. Usually we'd buy Shabbat's mincha, and then we'd say the prayer for the queen and other things. And one year they auctioned off a shir with Rav Lichtenstein. So we pulled together a bunch of us, maybe Shana Bet group, we did that as well, and we had a share with him, and he said, what do you want me to talk about? So there was back and forth, and at the end of the day, we spoke about the importance of childhood one year, and then another year we asked, just tell us about you, tell us your biography, so to speak, don't give us, the art scroll version, but tell us about, growing up and what life was like. And it's interesting, he said that when he was younger, he was somehow always accelerated in school, always a couple of years above his age grade, his age, which meant that on the one hand, it was great because he was learning more, was exposed to higher level material, but he said that he wasn't socially as developed as his peers. And he'd often get singled out or make bad mistakes. And he said once he was in class in Chicago and the kids had played a trick on the Rebbe who stepped out for a minute. He had a phone call. He had to do something. He was called to the office. He went out and he came back in and the kids had moved the board around or written something or hid or something. And he said, what happened here? And he said, I didn't know. I was a kid. So I put my hand up and I just told him everything that everybody did. And so he got in trouble. They didn't like him for that. And that's how we are taught to view Yosef on this scene. He's a little kid. He's 17. He's a nar. And he just goes and tells his dad, oh, daddy, do you know what they did today out in the field? And they're like, oh, this guy, he can't stop. It's unbelievable. That's what we're taught to imagine. Although it is strange because he's 17. How much younger than his brothers is he? I don't actually know the exact answer to that, but we had all the ages last week, and it wasn't like 20 years, right? It's like a few years. He wasn't like that much younger than everybody else. So it's not that compelling that he would be so far removed in terms of social development. And the Malbim has a very particular view, and you don't have the Psukim, all of you, in front of you, so I'll apologize if this is too in the text. But what I'll show is what the Malbim does. He said, we have to read this carefully. Yosef ben Shivasre Shana, he was 17 years old. Hayaroeh et echav batzon. How would you translate that? He shepherded roeh et echav batzon. That he shepherded with his brothers the sheep. Right, so that's how Rashi reads it. That's how the Art Scroll translates said. I don't know if you have other translation. It says Yosef was shepherding the sheep with his brothers, meaning he was out in the field with them. The mom says et as a participle can actually have a different meaning. Roeh et echav batzon. He was shepherding his brothers with the sheep, meaning he was teaching them. Despite the fact that he was younger, he was training them in how to shepherd sheep. Probably he was more accomplished, he was more sensitive, he was more naturally talented and had the aptitude. And he shared that. He was roeh et echav. He was their shepherd.
The next et is even more puzzling.
The next et is the next, exactly. Et b'nei Bilhav et b'nei Zilpah. V'hu nar is not an independent phrase, and he was a youth, because we take that out of context, but it's v'hu nar et b'nei Bilhah. He was a youth with b'nei Bilhah et b'nei Zilpah, with the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. What does that mean? He was a youth with them, and he was a shepherd with them. There's a lot more puzzles if we read this slowly. It seems to be there are two things going on, and he's a nar with one, he's a shepherd with the other, and this is what the Malbim says. A nar means youth, but often it has a connotation in particular to do with hierarchy. What is a nar usually?
An apprentice
or an attendant. When Avram goes to the Arkada, he takes his son and Shnei Na'arav Ito, his two attendants, With him, nar is often used to say an apprentice, an attendant, or an assistant. So what we're being told there is, hayaroa et achav batzon, his brothers, meaning the brothers of the elect mothers, let's say, he was training in the field. And we have to imagine the scene, this family. They're all these children, we view them as one pack. But it's not entirely true, they have different mothers, and hierarchically, some of the mothers are maidservants, some of them are chosen, and there's a tension in the family. Again, sitting around a Shabbos meal, you get a sense that people would sit at the different ends of the table, and different sides of the table would have their own cultures. And the assumption the Malbim presumes is that the children of Rachel and Leah look down on the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. Said, yeah, you are, you know, we share a father, but your mothers were no our mothers. They were a little lower caste, and we're not that involved. We're not interested. And there was this tension. And the more elect brothers would be in the field shepherding, and they would neglect their younger brothers. So Yosef was the bridge. This is what Malbim reads. He roed achav batzon, the brothers who were out with the sheep, he would train them. He would shepherd them. He would teach them. And what about the other brothers? Na'ar et b'nei Bilha. He would assist them. He was their attendant. He made himself subservient to those brothers in She'aviv. V'yavo Yosef et dibatam ra'ah, and he brought this bad matter to his father. What was the bad matter? Rashi says that he would say all the little things they were doing wrong, the tattletale that we're taught to imagine. But Malbim says, no, he went to his father and he said, Dad, you probably don't see this because everybody tries to be calm in front of you. No one wants to make a big deal, but you should know there is a fissure in the family. The brothers are looking down on their siblings because of their mothers, and we need to address this issue. So actually, he's a sensitive figure who, on the one hand, is training his brothers to help them. Even though he thinks that what they're doing is improper, he's lending a hand. And the brothers who have been cast aside, he's being an attendant, who is going to care for them, to help them, to be a friend to them. And actually, he's quite a... He's not this Na'ar who we imagine is sitting there twiddling his hair as we taught and kind of tattletelling and doesn't know what he's doing. He's a young man, he's 17, and despite his young age, he's accomplished at teaching, at pedagogy, at shepherding, while at the same time being sensitive enough to those who are cast out to go and help them. Yeah.
I was wondering if anybody picks up on the fact that Na'ar, if you don't read it with the kuzot, you could read it as an e'er, which has a whole different meaning. It's like an erumayim, it's like kind of sweeping up, riling up maybe, or sweeping under the... You
know, like to stir.
Like to stir. Right.
Who near it, Bnei, and he... I get, right, if you see him... Right, that's interesting. I've not seen that, but it's a fascinating possibility. If we take a different view of Yosef, that actually he is divisive and he is disruptive, and he's out in the field shepherding his brothers, meaning he's got no business shepherding. He's younger than them. They know what they're doing. He's like, you should do it like this. Nobody likes somebody who tells people what to do when they don't have the qualification. Anyone here? I don't know where this might lead. Anyone seen The Apprentice on television? Anyone heard of The Apprentice? Yeah, I just realized, as I said it, we're going to get into politics. I didn't mean that, because I don't follow the American one. There's a British one called The British Apprentice, and the figure at the center of it is Lord Alan Sugar, who happens to be Jewish and happens to have been chairman of the Board of Governors of a couple of Jewish schools and various other things. And so I didn't mean to wade into politics. But there is, you see, they've got these contestants come on and they try to run businesses together and win the task so that they'll eventually get an investment from Lord Sugar. And you watch this. And it's almost like throwing a bunch of young, aspiring, ambitious people into a Petri dish and say, now work together. It's a stranger thing. You have to beat each other, but you have to respect each other and work together even though you hate each other. And some of the scenes, you've got these people who are less accomplished, you don't know what they're doing, who are in charge telling people what to do. And people resist, they resent that. And then obviously that team loses the task. And here we have Yosef maybe trying to train his brother. They say, get out of here, who are you? And then he goes to the young brothers and he starts stirring them up. And he's just this disruptive figure. That would be a totally different reading of this scene. So again, we have ambiguity, and if we put the psukim under pressure, we can have radically different views of what is happening here. Now, for the Malbim, what did the brothers think Yosef was doing? Why did they think he was so bad? Why did they think it was their moral obligation to rid themselves and the family of Yosef? He's helping them, he's being generous, and he's reaching out to his brothers. So the Malbim says that they took that reading of that ambiguous scene. facts on the ground. He's helping the excluded cast out brothers, and he's teaching the brothers in the field. Let's just say those are facts on the ground for the Malbim. That can be read in one of two ways. It can be read in the way that, oh, he's being haughty and arrogant, trying to teach the brothers in the field, even though he's younger. And he's associating with these cast-outs. He obviously is just, you know, the base of society. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's hanging out with the gangs, right? So the brothers think this guy's not good news, and we have a moral obligation to be rid of him, when in fact what Yosef was actually doing was doing his best to help out those that were not deserving and subservient or make himself subservient to those who are in need. So two radically different readings of that same behavior. Yeah.
I think it goes back to the Hamaloth Timloch. Who are you?
Right. So this, it is a, let's put it this way, it is a lot of effort to maintain the view that throughout this, the brothers had good intentions. There is a moment when they turn around, as you say, and they say, you think you're going to rule over us? Who are you? It's hard to paint that in a positive light. I mean, you could always change the tone and said, I don't think you're appropriate to rule over us in any way. But it takes a lot of imaginative effort to construe this in positive light. You're right about that. So that's the opening scene. We've got these brothers as contention. We haven't even hit the first dramatic moment. This is just the first pasuk. Well, actually, the second pasuk, where we've got this scene. Joseph with the brothers, he passes bad news to his father. Okay, we're then told the Yisrael ahavet Yosef, and Israel loved Yosef. Who's Israel? Yaakov. Who's Yaakov? Israel. Why do we keep switching? We began two psukim ago, v'yeshev Yaakov be'eretz mugurei aviv. Now we have v'Yisrael ahavet Yosef. Can't we just keep the name straight? I don't mean to be irreverent, although that was irreverent. But that's the question some of the commentators ask. Why do we keep flicking around? Especially as last week, after his name was changed, there was a pasuk that said, you shall no longer be called Yaakov. Okay, God, I'll try my best. And then God himself says, v'yeshev Yaakov be'eretz mugurei aviv. Why are we flicking about? And the commentator suggested, actually, these names are now indicative of different tones. And different commentators take it in different ways. Some commentators presume that Yaakov is a more material name and Yisrael is a more spiritual name. And when we say v'yeshev Yaakov, we're talking about a material habitation. And when it says v'Yisrael ahavet Yosef, we're being clued in that this love was not just a natural paternal preference, but this was v'Yisrael ahavet Yosef. It was the spiritual dimension that thought this child has a character that is worthy. That's an indication that a number of commentators take, but it's viewed in different ways. Yosef then has his dreams. What are his dreams? Dream one was? Well, let's put it this way. Two dreams. What were they each about? Don't give me the order. It doesn't matter.
Sheaves.
And the stars. One is that he was in the field and the sheaves all bowed down to him. One is that he was in the heavens and he was being bowed down to by the stars and the moon and the sun. I think, were any of you here at the Malava Malka for Yes a couple weeks ago? Yes. There you go. So I mentioned this briefly then. Apologies for the repetition. But the Midrash says that it's not incidental that these dreams are filled with that material. It's true, of course, in the ancient world. You had limited vistas for your imagination. You couldn't dream about inner cities, right? Yeah, we're in the agricultural world, and you have the sky at night. That's what you saw. But it is pointed out in the Midrash that there is a major difference between the way that the righteous dream and the way that the wicked dream. Pharaoh's dreams were all around the river, this Midrash says, all around the Nile. And he dreamed kind of something ephemeral and passing and that just charges off. Whereas the dreams of the righteous bridge heaven and earth. We have here a dream of sheaves and a dream of stars, again, that bridge the heaven and earth. And what was the first dream that we have in Chumash? Yaakov with the ladder that literally bridges heaven and earth. And he says that is how the righteous dream. They try to bring heaven and earth together as opposed to just something ephemeral, chasing the latest faith. So the latest craze, rather. So that's one comment on the dreams. There's a lot more to say. One problem with one of the dreams is that Yosef has a dream of who bowing down to him in the sky? His brothers, his father, and his mother. The trouble is his mother's passed away. How does that ever come to fruition?
It's a dream.
All right, there you go. It's a dream. That's actually what Rashi says. Rashi says it's a dream, and every dream has something unfathomable to it. Now, the rest of it is going to fall into place. Any Freudians in the room? Any psychiatrists in the room who are familiar with Freud? Anyone familiar with my glasses cleaner? Sorry for those who are listening online, but I will describe for you. I'm taking my glasses cleaner out of my pocket. And that reaction is because there was a picture of Freud on my glasses cleaner. It was bought in the Freud Museum in London. I think they were selling a number of gimmicks in the shop. He spent his last year, he died in 1939 in London. He fled Austria, and he lived in Finchley, actually, in one of the Jewish areas. Not that he was particularly fond of Judaism. In fact, his final book...
In his apartment in Vienna.
And there's a menorah as well. He collected a lot of what we call, in the academic world, chupchiks, around his house, including lots of little idolatrous thingies and whatever it was, and he's got a menorah there as well. And the chumash, do you know where the chumash was from?
No.
His father gave it to him on his 35th birthday with an inscription in the front telling him you should read this more often, basically. he was brought up, and his father, there's a... Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi was a scholar at Columbia, wrote a book called Yizkor, Jewish History and Jewish Memory. I don't remember if that's the exact title, where he essentially makes the argument that Jewish history has never really been a priority for Jews until about the 19th century, when there was a turn towards history with the Wissenschaft des Judentum, the academic Jewish studies. We were all about memory. We were never about history. And he makes the argument there's a big difference, but he also wrote a book called Freud's Moses, where he tries to delve into Freud's religious thinking and life. His final book was Moses and Monotheism, which was a claim about religion. And actually, in a number of his works, he's got The Psychopathology of Everyday Life and a couple of other works where he describes some of his own dreams, where he used to dream and associate himself with Yosef, with Joseph. Why? Because Joseph was the dream reader, and he saw himself as kind of a modern Joseph who was reading dreams. So for those who are Freudians here, there's something relevant. Why was I going to talk about Freud? Thank you. The dream and his mother, this is not going to be Freudian in the dangerous sense, so don't worry about that. Oh, and I showed you my glasses cleaner, and you should know that in the store they also had Freudian slippers. But my wife didn't let me buy those, so I didn't buy those. They also had these little rugs that he had on his couch that you could buy as like coasters for your cups. But they were like 25 pounds. My wife said, just get the glasses cleaner. No, your foot goes into the tongue, though, of the slipper. So you've got your foot in your mouth. They put a lot of thought into that. I'm sure you can find them on Amazon. So in his The Analysis of Dreams, I don't know if this is... we'll leave that off. So in his Analysis of Dreams, he says that every dream has something called the navel. The navel, meaning belly button, meaning the core of the dream that we can't analyze. Even though he writes pages and pages of analysis of different dreams, and in his house in London, actually, they have illustrations of some of the more famous dreams that he describes and analyzing. And he says every dream has a navel. There's something in it that is just mysterious, inexplicable, where it, basically he tried to use the word navel, he tried to give it physiology or physiological terms where the subconscious and the conscious join. It's almost like a vortex. There's going to be something strange in a dream that I can't make sense of. So you shouldn't try to make sense of everything. But that said, he goes into a lot of detail about transference, condensation, all sorts of technical terms about how dreams function in the human mind, some of which I have to say I've found fascinating. When I was in yeshiva, this is a bit I wasn't going to mention. When I was in yeshiva, occasionally on break, I would read Psychopathology of Everyday Life. I found it fascinating, an insight into the human mind. And often I would find myself catching myself in Freudian moments. He's got a description of something called bungled actions, which is when you're doing something you're not even conscious of, that is betraying something in the back of your head. One example he gives, and I'm sure we all do this all the time, you get to your front door, or you get to your office door, or you get to the car door, and the key doesn't work because you've got the wrong key out. And you're using your home key to try to get into the office, or vice versa. And his suggestion is, we know which key to use. We're not idiots. It doesn't happen all the time. It's not like, oh, I didn't know which key. I'm going to have sometimes there's something kind of nagging in the bottom recesses of our subconscious. I get to the office and I'm trying to get in with my home key. I'd rather just be at home. And of course one could say, duh, wouldn't we all rather be at home than be at work? But there's something extra nagging in us. I was once having an argument with somebody, not a very aggressive argument, but a disagreement. And then I heard this beeping outside. You know, it's really frustrating in the middle of the night when somebody's car alarm's going off and you think, please turn it off. I've got a two-year-old sleeping, and if she wakes up, it'll be the end of my night. Maybe we don't all think that. Either way, and I was having this debate. It was when I was living in the Heights a few years ago. And this alarm starts going off. And I, why? Just shush, please. And then I realized that I'm holding my car keys and my finger is on the alarm button. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm panicking. It's literally called a panic button. And I'm sitting here, maybe I need to calm down and I need to resolve this in a more peaceful way and try and figure out what's going on. So just being aware, Freud has a bad rep for being all about unpleasant base urges. But actually, there's a lot of fascinating ideas and a lot of dreams I've had that I've given reflection to are brought to life in a new way. When you think about condensation in the way that he describes it, that sometimes the faces we see in dreams, you think you know who you're looking at, but actually it's somebody else, and you can't cope with the vision of that person in that scene, so you condensate somebody else's face on there, and you start thinking, oh, that wasn't my grandfather I was thinking of. I just needed that to be his face. And now that I think about it, that was somebody else. And it gives you insight into yourself. It doesn't make you a prophet. It doesn't make you Joseph. Joseph was not a psychoanalyst. He was a prophet. He was capable of predicting, not just assessing. But we have those dreams in that little navel through Rashi, through the presence of Joseph's mother, was our little pathway to Freud. So forgive me for that little aside, but that you never know where you might end up. So Joseph has these dreams. The brothers grow resentful. They throw him into a pit. And then there's this sale down to Egypt. Now, who sells him? Yeah, it's complicated. We all assume the brothers sold him. If you look at the unfolding of the verses, it looks like the brothers threw him in the pit with the plan to sell him, sat down to have a meal, which, again, you're trying to conjure up this scene. And when you read the psukim very quickly, one doesn't have to actually imagine it. But what is a helpful exercise is imagine turning it into a play or a movie. You want to put this out on the screen. Say again. Has this... Oh, you're right. Joseph. Pixar did it, right? Not Pixar. Who did this? Are you thinking of a more professional movie? Oh, Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, of course, right? That's true. But presumably they didn't sing in French at the time. There's a song in French. Nobody knows that song? It's done in English, but they're using like French cigars and then Pharaoh is Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
Right, thank you. So it's a little, it's a hodgepodge fun play. It's not like a serious, how do we imagine them at the time? Way, way back many centuries. They weren't sitting around with a goat, right? That's not what happened. It's interesting. The song that I think most hits, like, oh, this is an interesting reading, is when Joseph's in jail. Says, close every door to... Like, that's actually an interesting read. You know, the sitting around something about, we just call him Dad. Like, it's a funny tone. But either way, yeah, so they have made a play out of it. And you have to make choices when you make the play, or let's say you were making a serious movie, and it was DreamWorks or Pixar that did make... You know, they made Prince of Egypt about the Exodus. They also made one about Joseph. I don't remember what they called it. Joseph the Dreamer or something. I think it's on Netflix. But I don't think I saw that, or if I did, it was a long time ago. I don't remember it. What I try to think is, imagine, even if you're not a filmmaker, imagine you're just drawing this with a pen. How do I represent this scene? The brothers have thrown Joseph in the pit, and they sit down to eat. What is that meal like? How are they feeling? Are they contrite? Do they feel, is it hesitation? They say, we want to sell him, but you know what? We need to sit down and eat on this, so to speak. We can't just do it. We need a break. Or is this, they care so little about Joseph, they cast him in the pit, and they say, before we sell him, you know what, I'm quite hungry. Before we negotiate, I want to make sure that I'm full before I start having a negotiation over this cattle. Right? So how do you depict that? That's a complicated question that the psukim don't on them in themselves explain. Although one brother is absent at that meal. Who's absent? Reuven. Reuven has gone off somewhere. We know that because he comes back later and says, where's Yosef gone? So he's been absent the whole sale. And again, the sages try to figure out where Reuven went. And there are suggestions that actually he went off to do tshuva for something he had done the previous week, last week, with his father's beds. Some suggest he went off somewhere because, again, he was actually remorseful. He's the one who stopped killing him. The brothers were going to kill him, and he said, let's not spill any blood. And the psukim, incredibly rare, tell us what's in his head. Usually we don't get the intentions, but it says, and why did Reuven say, don't kill him? Because he was trying to save Yosef and give him back to his father. If I'm not mistaken, that's one of the only cases we have, maybe other than when it describes what's going on in Haman's head in the Megillah, in Esther, that we're told what he was thinking. The rest of the time we're left again with that ambiguity. We know how to portray Reuven in that movie. We're told what he's thinking. We're given his motivation. The brothers, we don't know. So that's a very interesting depiction of Reuven. The brothers are sitting there eating while Yosef's in the pit. We don't really know what to make of that. And then we're told that they were sold. That Yosef was sold. And it's very strange because the psukim seem to describe Midyanin coming along, picking him out of the pit, selling him, and then the brothers realizing and getting in on it in the last minute. And while they were eating, this was all unfolding. So they seem to have moved far away from the pit for whatever reason. And then this all unfolds without their foreknowledge. So that's an interesting thing. They take his cloak, they dip it in blood, they give it back to the father, say he's been eaten. Yaakov mourns, although we're told that he's never consoled. There's something in him that doesn't get closure or come to terms with this loss. And then we told Yosef was in Potiphar's house. End scene. And then we start talking about Yehuda and Tamar. And in the middle of this scene, which is going to pick up any minute, right after Yehuda and Tamar, we say, anyway, and Yosef was in Potiphar's house. But there is this huge interruption. Again, if you were putting this on as a movie or as a play, you'd say, stop. And everyone would be sitting there in suspense. Where's Yosef gone? He's in Potiphar's house. The story's not over. And now we're in a different scene in the desert with Yehuda and his wife and his three sons, two of whom have now passed away, the third of which is being saved till he's older. Tamar is sitting there waiting, wanting to move on with life, wanting to become a mother. And she's not allowed to marry because she's stuck in this pre-Yibum-Yibum relationship where she has to get together with the third son of Yehuda. And in the meantime, nothing's happening. So she goes to the crossroads. She dresses up as a harlot. And Yehuda finds her, makes use of her services, let's say, pays her with his ring and his scepter, which he just conveniently had with him. She becomes pregnant with twins. Yehuda then says, you're meant to be waiting. He didn't know who it was. Yehuda then sees Tamar is pregnant and says, you're meant to be waiting for my son. You've clearly been hanging around with the wrong kind of people, and you've betrayed my son's trust. We need to put you to death. At which point she could have done what? Have said, oh, well, I guess if you want to put me to death, you should probably put the father to death too. And he would have said, yes, who is he? Boom. You. Ooh, that's not good. But she didn't say that. What did she do? She just sent the scepter in a nice little FedEx box back to Yehuda's home and said, just by the way, this is the father's. He goes, ooh, this is messy. And he says, Hitzad Kamimeni, she's more righteous than I am. Maybe righteous is the wrong word. She's got more justice than I have in this situation. And he doesn't put her to death. And this actually is one of the biblical sources used for the rabbis, that it is better to die than embarrass someone. Because she could have stood up and said, Yehuda, you're the father. And instead she says, I'm going to send a somewhat cryptic note that nobody else will understand. And if he wants, he can ignore it. I'm not going to, call a hearing. I'm not going to have a press conference. I'm going to send a little cryptic note. And if he decides to sweep this under the rug, I'm just going to have to die because I can't embarrass him publicly. And this is where the rabbis say Tamar was incredibly righteous and she was willing to die so as not to embarrass Yehuda. And in fact, the Gemara says, and not only should one person be willing to die, because how many people were going to die? Three. She was pregnant with twins. So life, though the most precious in Jewish life, in Jewish thought, embarrassing someone is seen equivalent to murder. And there's a whole halakhic description of how literal that is, because the rabbis say in a number of places it is better to jump into a fiery furnace than to embarrass someone. And there were questions about, okay, I get the idea. Is that literal? Is it literally, Yehareg Val Yavo, better to die than to do this? How many things are there in Jewish life that one should die rather than do? What do we say?
Three.
The big three. What are the big three? Murder. Depravity, sexual immorality, and idolatry. Worshipping idols, sexual immorality, and murder. Those are the three that you have to die. Does embarrassment come up in those three? Doesn't seem like it. Some say that it's actually a version of murder. And actually, there's only one view in the rabbinic medieval period that says this is what we call guzma. This is just it's hyperbole to make a point. Other people seem to be pretty convinced this is literal, that it's better to die than to do, and they figure out how embarrassing somebody fits into the big three. In fact, Tosfos says it's not just three, there's actually four. Embarrassing somebody is something you should rather die than do. And then there are obviously halachic questions about this, which is, hold on a minute, pikuach nefesh on Shabbos. If you have a choice on Shabbos between somebody dying or breaking Shabbos, what do you do?
Break Shabbos.
Break Shabbos. So what happens if you have a choice in Shabbos between embarrassing somebody and breaking Shabbos? If they're equivalent, if it's like killing somebody, maybe I should break Shabbos first. I'm not paskining, calm down. But the Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach poses this question in his tshuvas and says, we have to assess how serious this is. Because on the surface, it sounds like we should be... Obviously, we don't practice this. But on the surface, it sounds like this needs to be investigated. That if we end up, having somebody ashamed on Shabbos, if that's like murder, why don't we break Shabbos? Let's put it that way. He doesn't say we need to assess the psak on this. He says, I know the psak, that we don't break Shabbos for this, but I need to understand why. Because we've just said it's like murder.
We don't consider adultery as murder. We don't consider a zora as murder. This phrase is used as if you would have murdered someone. So it doesn't really mean literally that embarrassing somebody is killing somebody.
Yeah, and that's the Me'iri.
There still is only three.
So that's the Me'iri, right? That's the Me'iri's argument that it's a turn of phrase. And the truth is, on the surface reading, I think that's how we would instinctively all see it. This is a turn of phrase. This is a pedagogical turn to say, if you embarrass someone, it's like you've murdered them. But a number of the commentaries, Tosfos and others, seem not to view it that way. They seem to think this is literal. And the reason it uses the as if is to tell you which category it's under. It says it's as if it's murder, meaning it's not the same as adultery. Or it's not the same as idolatry, but it's the same as murder. That's how they read it. And it's a very strange thing. But he's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has his whole reading of this, which, again, I only raise to make us more sensitive to shaming people, not necessarily to bring down the house on the halachic system. As Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, we're not going to shift psak on this, but there's some legwork in our thought that we need to do on this subject. I see we're getting close to the end of our time and we didn't even put pressure on our pasuk, but we put pressure on other things. Let's run through very quickly what happened to the rest of the parasha. Yosef then, after the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which eventually we're told is what leads to the birth of Mashiach, leading through Yehuda, through Ruth, and then down to the Mashiach. Now, Yosef's in Potiphar's house. He suddenly becomes in charge because Potiphar sees he's so successful. Somebody else sees he's quite successful in Potiphar's house. Who is that?
Mrs.
Potiphar. Yeah, that doesn't go too well. Mrs. Potiphar starts to try to seduce him. We're told daily she would try to seduce him. And eventually there was one day, coincidentally, it was a staff bonding trip. Everybody went out apart from Yosef and Potiphar's wife and they're sitting at home. He's sitting there going, oh boy, I'm not looking forward to today. And she's thinking, oh boy, this is my chance. She takes him into a room, tries to seduce him, grabs his clothes, his cloak, and he says no. And he runs away and leaves his clothes behind. Which, by the way, if you're trying to avoid accusations, you probably shouldn't leave your clothes in the woman of the house's bedroom. But it has been pointed out that actually Yosef was so concerned that he might trip up on this. He said, I'd rather be punished for something I haven't done than get away with something I have. So if I end up leaving my clothes and get put in jail, I'd rather that than I succumb to this. So I just have to run. And if she keeps it, she keeps it and whatever it is. Yeah.
Well, his father did the same thing. He left the stick with the
tamar. Oh, Yehuda, his brother. His brother, yeah, they seem to be leaving a lot of stuff around. It's a good point. We should keep more control over it. They should want those announcements they have in the airport. Please keep your things with you all the time. They should have that. Yosef runs out. It's interesting. It says, Ve'yanus ve'yetzei achutza. He fled and he went outside. Which again, the commentators say, just say ve'yanus achutza. And he fled outside. What do you mean? He fled and he walked outside. So the different readings, one of which is he was actually so attuned to that he was being watched. He fled to the doorway, and then he thought, if anybody sees me running, there'll be suspicion. So he caught himself, and he started walking the Yetzer Chutzah. He didn't think no one's going to pay attention to the fact that I'm not wearing a top, but he did think that they're going to see I'm walking, and maybe no one will pick up on that. That's the way the Netziv reads it. He gets thrown in jail. Again, it's very complicated how he is treated by Potiphar. It seems, for a number of commentators, Potiphar actually believes Yosef. And he knows that his wife is a scoundrel. Anyone see on Netflix The Spy about Eli Cohen?
Yeah.
So in one of the early episodes, and I say that because I've only seen the early episodes, I don't know what happens later, don't spoil it for me. So in the early episode, one of the ambassadors, his wife is being a little inappropriate with Eli, the spy, and you get a sense that she was doing this secretly, and then later the ambassador says, yeah, I saw that, I know she's a scoundrel, don't worry about it. And here we get the sense that Potiphar maybe knows his wife is like this. And actually, when he puts Yosef in jail, if you again look at the text, you put it under pressure, it says, v'yikach oto, he took him, and then he threw him in jail. And the presumption is he took him, meaning he took him to the side, and he said, look, I need to put you there because we have a reputation in the town and I have to believe my wife. I have to keep us together. This is just a marriage of convenience, but do me a favor. Go to jail. I'll treat you well, which is why it says he went to jail and he was with the prisoners of the king. Just say he went to jail. It says he was actually said, I'll put you in, what do they call where?
Otisville.
What do they call it? They call it the Jewish Club Med, or the Jewish Club Fed, they call it, right. This is where Michael Cohen ended up, right? Last year, right? So he said, don't worry, I'll put you in the good jail, I'll put you with the good people, you won't get the bad treatment, and do me a favor, you'll be fine, and I'll put in a good word, which is why he ends up being in such power in the jail. So that, again, you can read that text completely differently, that he was cast down and thrown out and Potiphar didn't believe him. But there is, I just draw that to your attention because there are different ways of reading this. He ends up, he interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker. Then the butler goes up back to his job. The baker is dismissed in polite terms or beheaded in less polite terms. And then Yosef is left on whose birthday? The only birthday in the Torah is mentioned, Parah's birthday. The butler comes up and is celebrating. He's there. He's got to have a party planner. So he says, all right, get the butler back. So he has a party planner and his birthday, and Yosef is left in jail. That's the end of this week's parasha. Next year, we'll talk about the first parasha for this week's parasha. Who knows? I could have done my drasha on this now. Who knows? All right. I wish you all a wonderful week, a good Shabbos, and I will apologize for going slightly over time.